Welcome to PNN Radio, and welcome back to reality. And let's see, we're going to have to mute a microphone here because I'm hearing myself talk. So how are we going to do this? Folks, I want to play a little tune for you while I sort this out with the mic. We'll be right with you with some guests here in just a moment. In the meantime, I'd like to introduce myself and the show. It's time for Rod to welcome you back to reality. And who knew that commercials could teach us everything we need to know? That song was by the World Entertainment War, and I heard it for the first time when I was working out in California in 1991. The author of that song, Rob Bresny, was pretty prescient for the time that it was written. Now, it may well be the case that corporate media, heavily influencing everything that we think about in our world today, isn't such a new thing. As we get older, I guess we become a little bit more aware of it. In any event, we're not going to be selling you a basket full of illusions on this show. We'll talk about things that you haven't heard before on your local corporate media channel. We'll talk about things that affect you in your everyday life, like, oh, I don't know, how much you're earning, why as productivity increases, you don't get to see any of the fruits of your increased productivity. We'll talk about things that are important to people right here in Florida, like the Water and Land Conservation Amendment that's going to be on the ballot in November. That's pretty important to anybody who has to rely on the Florida aquifers for the drinking water, which is pretty much everybody in Florida. I know that I live in the Green Swamp area, and the water levels were extremely low when I moved into this particular area. And while on the one hand we have these extremely low levels of water, we have a company down in Zephyr Hills that is busily bottling it up as fast as they can out of our Green Swamp area and then selling it back to us at $1.50 a bottle. But to be fair, this isn't just an environmental show. This is a reality show. So there are a lot of real issues. We've got an election coming up in November, and we've got the biggest thief in the United States, one who narrowly escaped prosecution with his Columbia HCA, and apparently was under investigations by other agencies in the United States, one of them just over in Tampa, for possibly manipulating or defrauding the price of the hospital that he was attempting to buy that at the time was called Tampa General. And somehow this man bought the governor's mansion in Tallahassee. So we've got loads of issues, and we should be thinking about them now with this upcoming election. But specifically back to the environment, I'm pleased to have with us as our guest tonight the president of the Environmental Caucus of the Florida Democratic Party. So we'll be welcoming Bill Buccolo to our show this evening. I hope I pronounced that right, Bill. So without further ado, I'd like to have you just introduce yourself and share with us briefly what your background and experience is as we introduce you to our PNN audience this evening.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for asking me in. The name's Buccolo, and that's close enough for government work, I guess, although we'd like to see that somewhat better quality in our government work across the board. And the Environmental Caucus tries to attack some of that. We the great there are so many cultural divides in terms of politics and issues like the environment. You'd think it's obviously all one big political thing, and it is in a sense, but there are all these tenuous little strings. For instance, all these great organizations we have already, the conservation organizations, sponsoring Amendment 1 on our ballot in November, organizations like Audubon, Sierra Club, and so forth, have restrictions about what they can do politically. They have restrictions about who they can, you know, some have policies about endorsing, some don't endorse at all, some are very strict about what they do and what they say, and so forth. So we set up the Environmental Caucus actually it's connected to the Democratic Party, and it's basically people who are registered Democrats. Most of them are involved in local DECs in each of the counties, and you don't have to be, of course, but you have to be a registered Democrat to be involved, and it provides, in theory, it's set up to give us a way to provide a bridge to the environmental population, the environmentalists who are in all these other organizations but don't necessarily hear who a good local candidate would be in Vero Beach, for instance, or in Jacksonville, or in Orlando or Tampa, simply because the environmentalists who are there, who know most of the facts and do most of the heavy lifting when it comes to facts and issues affecting the environment, don't really have a way to be political. It could actually cause lawsuits that would totally, you know, shut down an organization like Sierra Club if they said the wrong thing or did the wrong thing. And as you know from the 70s on, when they became so powerful, there are now conservative organizations that sit around just waiting for them to, you know, not cross the right T or dot the I or whatever, and then throw them in the court and cost them big bucks. So we are a political arm. We style ourselves as aggressive environmentalists, and we are building slowly. We were chartered by the Democratic Party in 2012, and we've been building slowly. We have a huge bunch of people who are on the books with us in Tampa Bay between Pinellas and Hillsborough, where I'm based. We have a terrific organization in Jacksonville. We have a good, strong group in Gainesville, a lot of people who are active with the DEC there, and a bunch of Hellraisers up in Tallahassee who are very active, very good, and we have connections in the unions. We have connections into the clubs, the dozens and dozens of Democratic clubs. And we are neither a club nor a DEC. We have different kinds of financial guidelines. We have different kinds of membership guidelines. And so we are involved now in our first big statewide action. We're working on promoting candidates like Dwight Dudley, who's been fighting with and showing and illustrating to people how bad the policies of Duke Energy are around the state. Then Duke's footprint extends into, I don't know, somewhere pretty close to Orlando and over west towards Pinellas County and down into Pasco and Pinellas. And they're famous for, you know, knocking people up for an extra $3.2 billion called an advanced recovery. But the Public Service Commission is okayed. So these are things we work on, and candidates we'd like to help.
They're hitting me up for about half of that $3.2 billion, it seems like, over here, Bill. I just got my electric bill today. I'm in shock. I'm pretty sure that there's something funky going on with that. Out of curiosity, how did you get into this? I know I've seen you active in these environmental issues for at least 3 or 4 years, even before the Democratic Caucus was Environmental Caucus was started.
I'm a political animal. I am a political animal. I've followed politics since the late '60s when I was in college. I was involved in the Southern Student Organizing Committee and DS in those days, published underground newspapers with others. Was actually thrown into court for a trumped up case of obscenity back in the late '60s, and a case that the Playboy Foundation and the ACLU stepped in to help with expenses on and research on, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. Eventually got thrown out. The county of Palm Beach had actually stuck stuff into our newspaper at the printer and then sued us for it, or arrested us for it for obscenity. We go way back. I got back into this stuff in the around 2000, following the debacle of the you know, the election here and the miscounting that went on, and later on got pretty deeply into the voting machines issue, and I still am, but there's not much you can do at this point except we've realized that you can win elections no matter what they do to you, as long as you you know, bury them in votes. And that's essentially what we did in 2008 and 2012 with Obama. They just bury them.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. They do still. I mean, I'm one of these guys who still thinks that elections are can be stolen and do get stolen. You think of the election with down in the old 13 and Sarasota, the old when Vernon Buchanan, you know, was a given the House seat for Sarasota because the supervisor of elections they lost 18,000 votes. So I mean, there's and nobody's ever, you know, really figured out what that's about, although we can pretty well deduce it. Ticks is just something that, you know, I just heave to. I like it, and I don't. Yeah, come to think of it, I don't like it. It's just what it is. You know, you're just compelled to be involved, probably like a lot of people. You just hold your nose and jump in.
Yeah, there you go. So we had we were privileged to have Brent Turner on a couple weeks ago from Open Source Voting. Bill, I don't know if you were able to catch that show or not, but Bill addressed some of those issues. Of course, he got involved back in 2000 and 2004 when we had all the voting irregularities. Everybody remembers the hanging chads the debacle of 2000,
you know,
and then we moved right along into to 2004 with the guy up in Ohio, Blackwell, the Secretary of State, who promised to deliver the state of Ohio to the Republican Party. And apparently he did it by owning part of the voting machine company.
Well, you know, you had ES&S and Diebold, later changed his name to Premier. But the Yurosovich brothers, two guys, one owned the ES&S and the other owned Diebold, and one of them famously said at a political party, and actually the president at the White House, I believe he said, we're going to make sure that the Republicans win. I mean, this is back when the voting machines were paperless, had no paper, except they would print out a little printout. It would spin out a little printout later, but there was no audit trail on the electronics. You can't watch electrons, you know. thank God, you know. In fact, I give Charlie Crist credit for one of the many things he did that surprised and infuriated his Republican compatriots was that he shoved a law down their throats to force them to use paper ballots. My own theory is that, you know, a lot of people who knew what was really going on with these machines were starting to get worried that they were going to get found out. We can talk about why the DOJ never prosecuted or investigated, but you know, it's all conspiracy. It's all, you can just talk about it. We'll never really know the facts until maybe some historian will uncover some kind of evidence a generation or two from now, but we're stuck with what we conjecture. But yeah, the voting is wonky, and at the end of the day, I've resolved my own conscience. You know, I've been able to live with it just by knowing that as long as we bury them in votes, they can't shave the precincts, they can't shave and flip enough numbers to win if you give them so many numbers that they just can't get away with it. And you overwhelm them. I mean, it's the only way you can do it. And God knows we've got the numbers to do it. All we have to do is get kids off their butts and other people who, you know, who are understandably busy with their lives. It's hard to take seriously a lot of stuff in politics because it's all the tug and pull of the different kinds of interests that give you news, and you never know what you're getting. But, you know, you do know at the end of the day that if you bury them in votes, your guy can get in, and, you know, there you start the job of, you know, improving the kind of people who get in.
We got our work cut out for us. Got our work cut out for us, Bill. But I think that while the voting issue is an important one, especially just whatever 45 days out from the election, I think you came to talk about some environmental issues that you're working on.
Oh, sure.
I,
yep.
know that we have an amendment on the floor ballot for the amendments to the Constitution for the water and land conservation, setting aside funds from our dock stamps. Do you want to talk about that, or maybe the issues with the Niagara and Zephyr Hills taking all the water out of our aquifer and bottling it up and selling it to us?
Well, I can tell you that the caucus has taken water on as its you know, primary goal to alert people, to educate voters about it, and look for candidates who understand that. And what we have hydrologists that are involved with the caucus. We have agriculture engineers. We have various kinds of people who are professionals. And we've been watching this since we prepared our charter. One of the first things we met to do and decided to do was concentrate on water issues. And we know that fresh water, the wells, the streams, the springs, the flow rates are going way down. We know that minerals are seeping and leaching into our wells. We know that the aquifer only has so much, you know, there's only so many times the aquifer can replenish itself overnight. And it's only getting worse, and it's something that it troubles all of us, and we have to keep educating people about how important it is to cut down the flow and look for other ways to, you know, we only have so much fresh water. So, yeah, it's a big issue for us, and we look for candidates and organizations that want to work with us. We have a limited number of people, and we're a caucus. A caucus is a group of people who agree on certain things and want to work on it within the political structure they have. That could be nationally or, you know, in your local town. And so this caucus is organized around environmental issues and how we can help the things we care about in a political way with our candidates. And water is a key thing. We're very lucky to have a candidate like Dwight Dudley, who's focusing on our Public Service Commission and Duke Energy. We need a corollary. We need a guy like that or a woman like that down in southeast Florida to deal with Florida Power and Light. When you think about it, we're surrounded by issues, horrible issues, like 350 degrees, and we're in the center of it. And we're like in the center in fact, it's more than that, it's three-dimensional. We're just surrounded by things going on. And every one of the protagonists that have money and trained people, and Democrats and progressives, basically we are who we are with very little money, and we work every day on these things without the benefit of deep pockets or heavily or well-trained, you know, managers or tools, and, you know, so we make our own. So it's amazing what we all do.
It's
your
amazing,
radio show,
though. We have a lot of brilliant people among the progressive community, Bill, and I think that really is where our strength is. So even though we may not have the money to hire managers, we have people stepping up to the plate like you, and I know Susan Smith with the Progressive Caucus jumped in and has been working in a lot of these same issues for the past, I guess, 15 years now. You mentioned candidates, and you mentioned Dwight Dudley. I think you mentioned a couple of other candidates also, and these are candidates that you've been, I guess, cultivating through the caucus.
Well,
and supporting.
I would love to say we were cultivating them. We do what we can in terms of the phone calls and the knocking on the doors and the donations. Just like everybody who listens here, you know, to some degree, if you care about an election, you're bound to get, you should be getting involved at some level. We all do what we can individually. The thing that the caucus wants to try to do, and this will be one of the first years we've been able to pull it off, is to get people in different parts of the state supporting people in other parts of the state. For instance, you may not have a great candidate in Pensacola, or you may not, you know, or down in Sarasota, well, I suspect there are some. But, you know, we might be able to get people from other cities around the state to help support a guy like Dwight Dudley, who, again, does not have the deep pockets that, you know, his opponent does. And that's an exciting prospect. We'll be using the candidate's access to Ban and Vote Builder. We'll be looking for ways to, you know, sponsor them with events, house parties, things like that. A lot of the things people typically do, they're in a party and they get involved in politics, they get involved in that election. But we're going to try to do that from statewide levels instead of just, local.
Sure. So do you have other candidates? Your Dwight Dudley is in the Tampa, Pinellas, Hillsborough area?
Yeah, we have candidates up in Jacksonville that our chapter up there is featuring. I don't have the name handy right now. There might be more than one. In fact, there are people getting on water and soil commissions and people running for city council or city commissions. And we're actually very hopeful we're going to have quite a few people. We are also very lucky to have several electeds. Probably half a dozen or so who are on important city commissions and councils now and county commissions who are active with us, and people who are involved with the League of Cities, which has an environmental organization within it that we plug into. And, again, it's working with the existing government, such as it is, and trying to make it better and also learning ourselves how to be more effective. It's a ship in a bottle. All little parts. It's taking years to do. It's going to take a long time to do the kinds of things that this kind of an organization can do. But I'm very, very hopeful and optimistic about it.
So we have a lot of issues around the water here in Florida, Bill. We also have the looming threat of offshore drilling and now onshore drilling, even in some of our most environmentally sensitive areas down in the Everglades. I guess the Environmental Caucus, you've probably got folks that are concerned about that as well.
Yeah, the fracking issue down in Collier County is important. The exploration drills, the drilling they did, they already injected crap into the ground down there. That limestone is very fragile, and they're blasting down there. They're injecting chemicals that will just poison the water. Water goes from the aquifer; it typically seeps south and east, we believe, and west. I'm a little out of my ken here, but we know it seeps down. We know that you could put dye in water. It'll turn up everywhere. Thousands of miles away, in some cases, they found. The fracking issue is very scary. People did a great job down in Collier County stopping it. We were involved with folks down there who fought a couple of years to retard, and finally stop that kind of stuff. I still think it's a miracle that the Department of Environmental Protection actually did its job and threw out Hughes Oil, which was doing the drilling and the fracking down there, working on fracking.
Yeah, I heard an update on that just in the last few days, and I think there were some questions. Dr. Karen Dwyer is often on PNN discussing the issues with the oil drilling there in the Everglades.
Yeah.
And she was saying that she had some concerns about the Department of Environmental Regulation letting them off the hook without getting some commitments for restoration restitution of the whatever damage has already been caused there.
Yeah, remediation.
Remediation.
She's been incredible. She is such a – we're so lucky to have people like her and people like her fighting this battle. I can understand. I'm not familiar with anything she said about the DEP in this case, and I want to go back and review your show with her and hear her. But I am just these guys are making the big bucks up of these jobs, these positions, they can neither afford nor they just don't have they wouldn't have the courage or the knowledge to go against what they're told to do or what they're given to do. You know, the public service commissioners make $131,000 a year each. If you've ever watched them on the Florida Channel, it's hilarious what they don't do. It's just amazing. And these guys are making these fat checks. There's no way these appointees in their 30s and 40s are going to do anything to rock that boat.
It would be hilarious.
My Lord.
It would be hilarious if the results of their ineffectiveness weren't so painful. Bill, I want to play a 1 minute soundtrack from Senator Soto on fracking in Florida, and then just get your response to that.
And so I asked if there was any indication there's any fracking or any fracking land or anything like that. And of course I got the response, oh, of course not, Senator. There's nothing going on there. What are you talking about? And even some right-wing organization said that I falsely claimed there was fracking. Oh, the justice. When about 2-3 weeks later, Danny Pugh's corp was found to be using some water pressurized fracking light procedures that were shattering the geology below. And they got caught. And they got caught in a big way. And it made the paper. And it was kind of usually it takes us decades, you know, to get some vindication. That was a couple weeks later we got a vindication. I could have wrote a script that fit better with the fact that our point was they didn't know what was going on and they didn't have control.
Yep.
So are these the same people you're talking about on the Public Service Commission, Bill?
Well, so I don't know who he was talking to in that, but the if it was in the last month, a few months, I guess it had to be to the commission since they're out of session now. But we do have some great, you know, some fantastic guys who are working against the tide, and people like Dwight Bullard also, who serves in that district down in that area, Senator Bullard. We have some excellent people, and you know we have to try to support them. And that's what the caucus would like to do, is help educate people about these legislators who are aware of what's going on and on top of it. In fact, yeah, they did. I think they were when Hughes. This is about Hughes Oil, and if I'm not mistaken. And again, they were surprised that anybody, you know, that they got thrown out. I think they were genuinely amazed that anybody really gave a damn. God, you know, look, they're from Texas. Look what's going on in Texas. People are, you know, getting sick, poisoned. They're trying to figure out why their water's bad. They just can't believe, you know, what they've been told, that fracking could really do that to them.
Yeah, it's always amazing to me the self-destructive tendencies of the average voter. Every place I've been, whether it's I work in Boston on a regular basis, I've lived in Florida most of my adult life, and I've worked in California, and it's just amazing that people will defend the guys that are stealing from them. They're stealing their wages. They're stealing their security. They're stealing their increased productivity. They'll defend those folks day in and day out. And then somebody comes along and actually says, hey, wait a minute, you know, maybe people should get paid a little bit higher wage, or, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should be protecting the water for the people, the residents who actually live here, instead of bottling it up and shipping it off out of, out of state and selling it to people all over the country. And they'll call them tree huggers and demean them and be angry with them.
You can't be surprised by now. I don't think anybody can be surprised that people don't always do what makes sense, especially in politics. It's so weird. I was writing about this on a post recently to some people on my Facebook page. We were talking about, they were citing Bill Clinton in a recent speech talking about Coke clones. And, you know, to me, that's pretty good, but, you know, they're Coke fools, really. I mean, it reminds me of, it shows you how powerful advertising and propaganda is. You've got about two generations of people who, and even before that, with rampant racism in the 50s and 60s when it was acceptable, you've got people who, you know, just consistently do stuff against their own interests, and it's sort of an effect of being educated. They don't know who to trust. They don't know. They don't believe, you know, the people we think are telling the truth most of the time. And so you can tell them something's going on and stick it under their nose and show them the evidence, and they just will not believe it. It just shows you the amazing and terrifying power of well done propaganda. And for all of their faults, the GOP and the conservative segment of the population that control a lot of the money and some of a lot of our government, I'm afraid, have very consciously, you know, done an incredible job of miseducating and misinforming huge segments of our population, easily steered to, you know, they focus on the abortion issues, and they focus on the anti-intellectual things that that people always have. They zero in on that. And it's amazing. And if you're on the wrong end of it, like we are, it's horrendous.
I want to relay a little story to you, Bill. I drove up a week or two ago to Starbucks, and I went through the drive-in and ordered a Frappuccino for my daughter, or I don't know, latte, mocha, something. And when I got to the window, it was the day that the McDonald's workers went on strike for $15 an hour.
Oh, yeah.
And I said to the lady in the window, I said, I was a little bit surprised to see that everybody was working today. I said, is anybody from Starbucks going on strike? And she said, no. She said, I heard about that. She said, I think it's McDonald's up north somewhere. And I said, well, I'm pretty sure that, McDonald's is doing that nationwide. I said, we've got McDonald's down here in Florida going on strike, too. I said, I think it's for, you know, the minimum wage for all fast food workers. And she said, oh, my. She said, that sounds like total economic collapse. And I said, that's certainly what the people that pay your salary want you to think. I said, that's, in fact, that's kind of what they said back in 1886 when the unions set May the 1st, 1886, as the date that they were going to quit working 12-hour days and 16-hour days. And they were going to go to an 8-hour workday. They said, oh, my God, we can't just, you know, we can't compete with an 8-hour workday. The whole economy is going to collapse. And it's kind of funny that today we live in America where apparently we supposedly have one of the strongest economies in the world. And how long have we had the 8-hour workday, the 40-hour work week now, about 120-some years, 118 years?
I was watching have you been seeing the Teddy Roosevelt feature on PBS the last two nights? They focused on PR.
And
it's wonderful. It's just it's not to be missed. And it reminds us of how things were when he took over and how he was and how he bragged about being progressive. And it's the same things we are now as progressive. But he actually forced the miners to knock back the work hours to 9 hours a day and got them a raise, a paltry 10% at the time. But it was he had to bring them in and threaten to take over the mines to do it. And it's so similar now. You're reminded, looking at how things were for workers and it's so poignant to watch what we're going through now and see what they did back then and what he actually did himself almost single-handedly back in the early aughts when he was president. Great series.
Did they talk about Ida Tarbell at all when they were talking about Teddy Roosevelt?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. Also, he was the first president to ever host a black man for dinner at the White House. My addled old brain doesn't remember which man it was, but it's just that he was incredible, and he was also a nutcase, and he loved himself a good war, but those were different days, and he was an ardent imperialist, but. There's two sides to every sword, and that side of his was pretty good. These days, we work. One of the things I do in Pinellas County is I'm very active with the Wake Pinellas, which is incredible with the progressives, and we work. We actually formed almost 4 years ago now with the help of union organizers, SEIU and IBEW guys connected to the AFL-CIO, and. Their organizers helped put Awake together. Still pretty strong in Pinellas and in Tampa, and it's reminded of how important the unions are. And we, in fact, in the Environmental Caucus, are actually looking for ways to work with unions because they have great apprentice programs for solar system workers and building trades guys have choices to make and what they recommend builders use and there are environmental choices to make in almost every case. And so we want to be on the right side of that too. And our Tallahassee group works closely with the unions up there who lobby and meet regularly. We will be working with a lobby core actually that we're putting together with the caucus this coming session. And we invite people, by the way, to get involved with the caucus. Wherever you are, you can do that. And that's one of the things you'll be able to do is work with our lobby corps and work in your local area with other people who are political and active and want to make things happen in an environmental sphere. To reach me, by the way, I want to put a little plug in. You can always reach me, folks, by emailing president@environmentalcaucus.com. Very simple address, president@environmentalcaucus.com.
End of commercial. Okay. We will repeat that a couple of times here during the broadcast, Bill. We want to make sure that the people that are listening that are interested in participating can get to you easily. You talked about the lobby corps. Can you go into a little bit of detail? Can you elaborate on that, what the lobby corps
is? It ties into what's going on. Some of the union organizations are doing in, there's a council of them, doing up in Tallahassee, and they're organizing places where you can go and stay overnight, where you can come in for breakfast at least, where you can get schooled in what's going on, what's current in the legislature, what the issues are that they want to work on, and then they'll provide you information for what the environmentalists want to work on as we work with these kind of people. I don't want to get too much into the weeds in this now because we're still setting it up, things might change to some degree, but the caucus itself is committed to working on this issue and making a presence for its members in Tallahassee and providing a presence to legislators on issues that, we want to provide the legs, the soldiers for a lot of the work that gets done by the other organizations, the environmental organizations that do a lot of the heavy lifting, the research and the providing data to the public. We want to be instrumental in getting that out. Of course,
do you have a list of these environmental organizations that you work with on your website?
No, there's no formal list. I mean, we do have a website, environmentalcaucus.com. You can go to that. But the fact is, we work with democratic organizations, and many of our members are members of established environmental groups who don't have a political presence typically.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, by the way, when I set the caucus, when I initially set up the caucus in 2012, since then the Sierra Club has become very active, much more active than they used to be. And they're very aggressive here where I live with the Green Light Pinellas, which is a mass transit program there with other things. I was a political chair for a couple of years with the organization in Tampa Bay, the Sierra Club group. Sunshine group. And that's where I got my eyes opened to, you know, what was needed in terms of linking up to environmentalists and connect, giving them a bridge to politics.
I was just going to say, so one organization that folks that are want to make a difference in could get involved with the Sierra Club. I suppose there are several chapters around Florida.
Many chapters, some regional where they don't have enough people. But you know, if you're in Broward County or Palm Beach or Dade County, or of course in Tampa Bay, there are two groups in Tampa Bay. It's just that there's so much going on. There's so many opportunities to work, and you have to decide where you can be most effective. I opted to set up the caucus at a time when I felt it was very difficult for me to work with, you know, to reach all of the members in the Sierra Club because of they're very protective of their memberships, even for things that, you know, it may seem obvious to some people that, you know, they should be all over the place, falling all over themselves to reach their members to do, but, you know, they're structured, you know, a carefully controlled organization, and they simply want to protect their membership. And so that every time something happens when I took over when I accepted the job as a political chair for the Sierra Club, they had, I think, 2,800 members, paid members in Pinellas, and I thought, my God, am I going to get some people elected now? Because, you know, 1,000 or so people, and if you could push 1,000 people in one direction, you're going to win elections in municipal areas. And so, but it turned out to be very difficult because when you sign up for Sierra Club, you get a little box to check if you don't want to be bothered. You know, if you don't want anybody to call you. So that shut that down right away. Listen, I'm running out of time. I have an appointment to go on to, but if there's anything else I can discuss with you now, I'd like to do it and get moving, Rob. And I really enjoy this.
Sure, Bill. Couple of things I wanted to just sort of cover before you have to go is that for folks in Florida that want to get involved in the caucus now, in order to be involved with it, they don't have to be members of their local DEC. They can join the caucus, just any Democrat in the state of Florida?
That's true. You should be registered as a Democrat to be a registered member of the caucus. That's the only restriction. And of course, if you're going to be an officer in the caucus, which is entirely possible, if you're active in your local chapter, you'll have an opportunity to do that. You have to be a registered Democrat. Also, you sign that. There's a loyalty oath that Democrats sign when it basically just says you won't support somebody who's not a Democrat in an election if there's a choice. One of the great things about a caucus, by the way, though, is that a lot of people are myths that Democrats, and I think it's true for Republicans too, cannot support anybody overtly. No organization can support anybody in a primary election where you have two Democrats running for office. We can do that for the caucus because we have a specific interest. We have a strong political interest in the area of environment. So if we decide somebody's better environmentalist in a primary, then we'll support them. We may support them. We don't have to do anything. And that's another interesting wrinkle with the caucus. So
with caucuses,
you know,
versus
we're still
clubs.
Learning how to do this. Yeah.
Sure. So they can go to your website. They can go to your website, Bill, at environmentalcaucus.com.
They can, and they can also email president@environmentalcaucus, and they can also, and this is what I actually prefer at this point, is go to Facebook. If you're a member of Facebook, jump into our state page, which you can just look up under the same name, or DECF. We use those initials a lot, DECF, like Frank, and look us up that way on Facebook. And, you know, write me a note. write me a note by email. I would love to hear from anybody who's interested in this. And, you know, I love talking about it, love scheming, coming up with the best ways to do things. We've got a real terrific quality of people involved with us.
All right, well, can we get
as well as retired people.
Can we get 1,000 people to go write Bill an email right now and flood his mailbox? So, Bill, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing with us about the Environmental Caucus and some of the issues that you've talked about. And I hope that we get a chance to get you back on the show again and as we get closer to the election or after the election and things settle down. And you've got your upcoming focus for, you know, the next couple of years as we move into the 2016 campaigns. And maybe you'll have some candidates in the wings that you're cultivating an environmental bench for the Democratic Party.
Love to put you in touch with them. And I look forward to it again. And I would love to, in the meantime, maybe I'll be able to send you some information about some of the great candidates we've got who really have a statewide value to everybody in the state, even if they're just in one particular geographic area. So, love to do this again.
We really appreciate the work that you're doing. This is an important job, Bill. And I know you got to go, but if you've got access to the website in your travels, we're going to be playing an interview with Dennis Campbell of the UK Progressive. It's a progressive magazine in Great Britain. And he also has a program, a video a cast called Worldview. And he's going to be sharing with us a little bit about I think it was a UN meeting that was held in Wales recently. So that's coming up. And then I'm probably going to be ranting about some of the political issues, probably a lot about getting rid of Rick Scott here in the next hour. So thanks a lot for joining us, Bill. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Rob. So long, everybody.
So I'm going to go ahead and kick off this interview with our good friend Dennis Campbell. And I might mention, too, a little bit about Dennis before we play his interview. About 4 years ago, I started an organization called the Progressive Leadership Action Network. And one of our first projects, your usual Sunday night host, Rick Spisak, was also one of our participants in this project. It was a book project, and we published a book called Fix America. The objective of this book was to identify this set of priority issues facing us in progressives who have a vision of the future that we've been sort of drifting away from for the last 30 years, and to collect up all these issues, because what happens is we tend to be reactive to whatever the latest story in the media is, and now everybody, of course, is all up in arms because some football player abused his son, and, you know, legitimately so. We should be concerned about that, and we maybe shouldn't want to support organizations like the NFL that teach people how to be vicious. But that be that as it may, what happens is that we have all of these issues. We've got a Republican war on women that's still going on. We've got Rick Scott trying to pass laws that make it harder for women make their own decisions in terms of their reproductive health care with their doctors. The right wing wants to stick their nose. But this right wing that says they want small government wants a government so big that it can stick their nose in the doctor's office with every woman that goes to see the doctor. So we've got that's going on, and we don't get a chance to talk about that. We've got, you know, the McDonald's story, the workers trying to get a working wage. That was a blip on the radar. It'll probably go away in the next week or two as whatever the next big story is. So all of these issues that are just constantly bombarding us, there are so many that as soon as we start trying to address one of them, they throw five more at us. And so the objective of our book, Fix America, was to collect up into one little collection of the issues that needed to be addressed, and then to suggest not just to be whiners and say what was wrong with America, but to actually suggest a way forward, to look at what the problem is, to try to understand the nature of the problem, why something is a problem, not just the fact that it's a problem and that everybody's unhappy about it, but to understand that sometimes problems are problems because it's in somebody else's best interest for that to be a problem. It's if you happen to be in the 0.1% of the population where your income has increased by 30% or 40% or 50% or 80% over the last few years, when everybody else's incomes have stagnated or else they've become unemployed, then if you're a 0.1%, life looks pretty good right now. But for the rest of us, it's maybe not quite all roses. So understanding that somebody may actually be standing in the way of fixing these problems, and then after evaluating what the problem is and who the hurdle is that you have to get past, proposing a way forward to actually fix them. So our thought was we would imagine a world that did work the way it should, or that worked better than it works today, and then to propose a way forward to get from here to there, to describe what a bridge from where we're at today to where we'd like to be, what that bridge might look like. So we published a book in 2011 called Fix America. And Rick, again, was one of the leaders in that publishing effort. And one of our authors in this book that contributed and was very helpful in our pulling all the pieces together to make it happen is our good friend, Dennis Campbell, who has a regular show called Worldview, in which he does things like interviewing people from all over the world. He often is up at 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning interviewing somebody over in China. And I would encourage everybody to look Dennis Campbell up, look up Worldview, and tune in to his video cast. Rick was fortunate enough to be able to get this recent interview with him, in which he talks about the issues around this meeting that took place in Wales. So I'm just going to play this for you now, and then when we get back, I will probably give you a few more of Rob's rants and see if I can't inspire somebody to action tonight. So without spending a lot more time introducing Dennis, we'll just...
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Mr. Dennis Campbell of UK Progressive and Worldview. Welcome, Dennis. How are you today?
Doing well, sir, and yourself?
Very good. Dennis, I understand you had a front row seat to the recent conference in Wales?
Yeah, the NATO conference was here. The circus came to town. It cost almost £50 million. It's about $80 million to protect everybody while they were here. And most of the activity, though, was reserved for those that were in the official NATO or the official White House pools. The rest of us sat in a big tent and sort of twiddled our thumbs and looked at a big screen the entire time. These gatherings are enormous waste of time for most of the people that are there. They're big on show and very little in substance. But every 2 years or so, they do go somewhere. But nobody ever remembers, of course, where they went. Yet it's a big financial burden for the country that does host them. We've had businesses in downtown Cardiff that were literally shut down for 3 weeks as the giant steel wall was erected up and down the A470 so nobody could make their way to half of the businesses in the city. And then, of course, when they were here, they left the confines of the resort about 18 miles away from the city. They were actually in Newport and had to all either helicopter in or motorcade in, so traffic was an absolute nightmare. There were so many people that wanted to catch a glimpse of President Obama, but he never came anywhere near Cardiff other than perhaps in Newport. He flew into Fifth Air Force Base, which is a real Air Force Base, just to the far western part of England, not too far from Newport, and then helicoptered over on Marine One up to the property. He then helicoptered to another part of Newport for Prince Charles's reception on Friday evening, and then got into the chopper and moved down into downtown Cardiff, where he parked next to the giant cricket stadium and then motorcaded for about a minute and a half over to the castle. And he was pretty much invisible, except they did get the money quote, which was someone who was actually at the prince's reception behind the rope line asked him, "Mr. President, as the first sitting president ever to visit Wales, what's your impression of Wales?" His reaction was, "Well, it's a lovely country and everybody should come and visit it." So the Chamber of Commerce people were quite happy with that. Yeah, these things are just so, I don't know, they're so contrived. I mean, everything is agreed on by aides to these 60 leaders, and really there's only about four or five that matter. It was really quite funny. You could tell the pecking order of world leaders by whether or not they entered the giant ballroom or wandered about with or without credentials. For example, the First Minister of Wales, who is the titular head of this country, at least provincially speaking, his name is Carwin Jones, and he stood there as the most expensive, well-paid doorman in the history, I think, of the world. Literally, a car would come up. It would disgorge one of the 60 world leaders that were here. Carwin would bound across and shake the hands, mostly getting bewildered looks as if to say, "Who the hell are you and why should I know you?" And he'd be introduced by somebody from the NATO staff, but, you know, it's the First Minister of Wales, and now, "Oh, yes, lovely to meet you." And then they'd go inside, and Carwin be standing outside, cooling his heels, shifting from side to side. We got to watch that repeat time after time. But the funniest moment was when President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron arrived from having visited a school. Again, 300, 400 people on the sidewalk waiting to catch a glimpse of President Obama. All they saw was a 15-car motorcade go into the school and come back out of the school. And nobody got much of a glimpse at all, despite, you know, being completely disrupted for all that time. When President Obama bounded out of the car, he came right over to Carwin and shook his hand. Cameron, sensing a political opportunity and a chance to be on television, came bounding around the other side, around the back, and he went to go and shake hands with somebody opposite where he was standing. Of course, Carwin and President Obama were involved in conversation, only to find out that he realized, no, that was politically not a very good thing to do, because he'd find himself in a situation where he was actually reaching over the President of the United States and the First Minister of Wales. So he literally did one of those high school sophomore moves where he reached across, attempted, and said, "Oh, not a good idea," pulled his hand back and started to sort out his hair, and it was as if you were, you know, down in the basement and the father of the girl who you were dating caught you doing the big stretch and put the arm around her and maneuver. It was very classic.
You know, lighthearted moments aside, there is some significant business for NATO to be paying attention to. I mean, we've got the Ukraine situation. We've got, you know, a terrible economic condition still in much of Europe. We've got, of course, the today's instant enemy, ISIL. Was there anything of substance agreed upon? Any official posture come out of it, do you think?
Nothing that the press has known anything about. I mean,
yeah,
you know, there were bilateral meetings going on by the Muslims. I mean, it was interesting because the White House was very surprised to find out that the King of Jordan had suddenly shown up. He's not a member of NATO. And there was a surprise meeting with the King of Jordan and the President. There was another surprise meeting with Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey. So there were a lot of discussions and a lot of side meeting rooms happening. But again, the way it was at least shown to those who were, you know, of the press or trying to, you basically, you know, had photo sprays that would last for 10 or 15 seconds in to get a photo of the President and whomever he was meeting. And then all that did was make the speculation in the press tent go crazy. People then wonder, okay, well, why are they meeting? Then finally, you know, hours later you'd get, well, it was just a planned or scheduled meeting. I'm sure ISIS was indeed very big on the agenda, as was Ukraine and Russia, as was to a lesser extent, the Ebola outbreak in Africa. But it's a very tight tight-lipped group. And if you think about NATO, the North Alliance Treaty Organization, it's mostly military in nature. So, there were a lot of military people around generals. I mean, there was a big flyover on Friday morning of, 20 or so NATO jets from each land. And, the opening ceremony had the color guards come through. The interesting thing about the opening ceremony was that they were honoring those who had served in Afghanistan. And the guy who was carrying the Afghanistan flag went AWOL just before the ceremony and applied for asylum in the United Kingdom. So you just had this comedy of errors from one moment to the next. It was just very strange.
Well, of course, it was invisible on American television. Needless to say, something of substance when there's starlets to cover,
Well, it was virtually invisible here as well. I mean, there were a few moments where the BBC would broadcast, but something happening on British soil, you would think there would be uninterrupted coverage and discussions and interviews. But even for BBC World News and others, it was here's a couple of minutes of what's going on at the top of the hour, and they showed the same four clips over and over and over again. So I wouldn't exactly call the coverage anywhere. And frankly, the fact that most of the media are shut out from those sorts of things to begin with, they kind of reap what they sow.
One would think there'd be at least an official memoranda from the NATO meeting that, this is what you're supposed to know about what happened.
Well, there's always an official communique at the end of all these meetings, whether it's NATO, whether it's G9 or G8 or G7, how many are left now. All of these official meetings end with a communique, but the language of that communique is agreed months before the meeting. So, it's almost just like, for example, President Obama will be going in November to China on a big journey there, and Susan Rice has been there for 2 or 3 days, working out all of the details of that state visit and trip and everything that's going to happen. They're also writing the communique for the end of the meeting with a couple of minor word changes, but what they sign will be known by all parties before they ever get there. That's standard operating procedure in something like this. They won't hold the meeting unless they're protected politically on both sides. It's the way these things operate.
Sure. Let me ask you this. From what we gather on this side of the Atlantic, the level of terror concern in the UK, at least as far as the general public is concerned, that it seems that the UK's terror level is higher, hotter, whatever you want to call it, than it is here. Although, of course, our president just made a statement about how we're completely justified in bombing more and sending more drones. What's the official word over in the UK? Why is there this enhanced concern about terror in the UK? Is it this elusive quality that you've got returning jihadist veterans who are going to wreak havoc on the UK?
Well, I think that's part of the official explanation. I have to tell you, yesterday being the 13th anniversary of September 11th, we're recording this conversation on Friday, the 12th, and I was in London all day, and I spent the night before in a hotel there, walking the streets, taking the tube, trains, buses. There was absolutely no indication. There was no heightened sense of police presence. I didn't see any armed police on the streets. I didn't see a huge presence anywhere beyond, the normal body walking by. And it was, if there is a heightened sense of it, it was clearly not in evidence anywhere that I went. And I was pretty much from one side of the city to the other in meetings and had absolutely no problems whatsoever. I think what happens is that, the meeting immediately after 9/11, you had the color-coded system come out in the United States, and it was used as a political tool in many instances, I think, to heighten a lot of what was going on. And keep in mind, we have a very important vote here next week on whether or not Scotland will secede from the Union. And although that may sound cynical, I would not put it past anyone to say, hey, this is an opportunity to remind the Scottish citizenry of the importance of staying in the Union just from the sheer self-defense motives, for example.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
never before has the terrorism threat been used as a political tool, right?
Well, as a matter of fact, the cynical among us here suppose that the reason the speech was given the day before September 11th, 2014, was so that on the 11th we'd all be talking about the importance of this new threat, if you will. Of course, a threat that we prepared
and armed. Because he was last week at NATO, all right? And so, I mean, he did not return until late Friday night, you know, and he had the weekend, and then he had congressional meetings, and then he made his announcement. I'm not cynical enough to say that it was just because it was before. Could very well be that maybe they were afraid on the anniversary of the date that might be considered insensitive to announce that they're about to go into another war, so that could also have something to do with it. I just don't see that as a motive. It's just the way the calendar actually happened to set up this time. He had to get all the ducks in a row, and he had to get all of the bilateral meetings. I mean, you know, I'm not fond of the need to have to do this, but he definitely has a much stronger coalition of the willing to go all the way back to H.W. to Poppy Bush. You know, there are a number of nations, the Arab League, and the deliberative nature of this president, I think has put a lot of people at ease, except, of course, those on the right who said he should have started bombing 3 weeks ago. But other than that, I mean, I don't know what else you can do if you're the leader of the biggest army in the world, and this is clearly something that everybody feels they need to do.
Well, you know, I have to wonder, this ISIL or ISIS or whatever have you, also formerly known as the moderates in Syria, also known as certainly not Al-Qaeda, because, of course, Al-Qaeda has denounced these good people. Folks like that don't exist on their own. They can't exist. They can't be armed without support. And the question seems to me to be, merely targeting the fighters doesn't address the fact that these people have been funded by something else. I suppose that's something we'll have to talk about another time. Dennis, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's always great to hear your perspective on things from the other side. And best of luck on all your projects. Is UK Progressive, you have a new issue coming out?
Well, we update that daily, and we've got some technical issues, but we've got that sorted. We're going to be starting a podcast next week called The Three Muckrakers, which hopefully will be on iTunes and Google Play very, very soon. Coming soon to a player near you. I've teamed up with a former BBC journalist by the name of Hugh Parry. He's very well known here. He left them about 2-3 years ago and has been doing a fabulous job with a publication called Whale's Eye of really doing what media should be doing and taking a deep, hard look at what goes on in the UK government. And also joining us as the third musketeer or the third muckraker is Professor Dario Linares, Dario double L on Twitter. And Dario has been, he's a media professor at the University of Falmouth who specializes in all things political and has written some really timely stuff for us on the way in which the UK media as well as others portray. So we're going to be looking at international news, UK news, as well as US news from a political point of view, and we'll have guests from time to time, and we're going to keep it pretty fast moving with a 60-second roundup for each topic, then a discussion amongst the three of us, and we'll just keep it moving fast. It should be about a 45-minute or so podcast that we're hoping to do on a weekly basis to let folks know politically what goes on, not just in the USA, but around the rest of the world.
Well, send us a link, and we'll be glad to post it for you. Thanks so much, and best of luck on the new enterprise.
Hey, thank you, sir. All the best.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So we're always happy to hear from our good friend Dennis. He always has enlightening information to share with us. One of the most brilliant broadcasters that I know, progressive broadcasters that I know in the industry. We appreciate his efforts, his good efforts with Fix America. And by the way, I would encourage anybody listening, if you're interested, if you want to have a good read, to go to Amazon.com, look for the book Fix America. It should be available We featured essays by folks like Al Franken on net neutrality. We had a piece by Joan Walsh. We had the Rude Pundit featured in this book. We had a few pieces by Lakoff, George Lakoff. He did an introduction for us. The book was reviewed by Alan Grayson. So a few of us, Rick wrote a piece, I wrote two or three pieces, and our third co-editor, Cassandra Vert, also wrote a significant number of pieces in Fix America. And I think it's a good starting point. It's probably time for us to do Fix America Part 2, because in the last 4 years, of course, we've had a number of new issues. Surprisingly, the war on women just came out of nowhere, the right-wing war on women with, I mean, who would have ever imagined that they would start coming after birth control in the 21st century? We kind of thought that battle was fought and won back in the 60s. It's just amazing to me how regressive this new right-wing is. I hope and I think that they are on the wane. They remind me a lot. I don't know how many of you folks have ever heard of the Know Nothing Party. This was a reaction to the immigration that came from Ireland during the potato famine in the 1800s. And there was a lot of concern in the Boston area about roaming Irish bands of hoodlums, of gang members, and the danger that they were posing to the residents in the city of Boston. And in fact, that's part of what led to the rise of public education in the United States in response to the problem with teenage crime and violence. But another one of the ramifications of that immigration was this Know Nothing Party. It was a xenophobic party that was hated immigration, hated immigrants, hated anybody that was different than them. And they saw the original settlers, I guess English settlers of Boston, of Massachusetts, were concerned that they were rapidly becoming a minority. And so their response to that was to start this new party. But unlike the Tea Party, or maybe very similarly to the Tea Party, actually, they created this party through just word of mouth. And the reason they got the name the Know Nothing Party was because whenever anybody would ask them, reporters would come and say, "We understand there's something going on. You got some candidate that's going to run. You're going to do a write-in." And they would do write-ins in these elections, but they would do it under the cover and with nobody knowing about it. And whenever anybody asked them about it, they said, "I don't know nothing. I don't know what you're talking about." They actually even won the governor's seat. They won a majority in the Massachusetts legislature. And it didn't last too long. I don't remember if it lasted two or three election cycles. But very similar to what's going on with the Tea Party, it's the xenophobia, the hatred towards anybody that's not like them. And as much as I know the Tea Party doesn't like to admit it, the racism that exists in the Tea Party's case, it seems to be more focused towards the black community, although I think that they're equally adamant about not liking Latinos. And, of course, we know what happened with Senate Bill 1070 in Arizona with anti-immigration against the Hispanic community there. We know all about the story of what's going on the border, where we've totally militarized the border. And for the life of me, I can't understand why all of these right-wingers and teabaggers are willing to just lie through their teeth about the fact that there is more protection of the border today than there ever has been in the history of the United States. And yet they keep talking about, "Oh, well, the president made the border less safe, made it more porous. He's responsible for all these immigrants pouring in over the border. I could rant on that for probably the rest of the show, but I've got more important fish to fry tonight. But the point is that we do have a serious problem with our voting. We do have a serious problem with the people that are often stealing seats in the legislature and in the Congress and in our state capitals. And we, like our last guest, Bill said, we just have to overwhelm the ballot box with so many votes that it doesn't matter how many thousands they steal, there's still going to be more for our guys than there are going to be for these racist xenophobes that we got running in the opposition party. It's about time that we put an end to rule by minority and started actually going out, turning out the vote, turning out folks to overwhelm the ballot box and to put people who are actually going to be working for the middle class instead of working for those one percenters. I saw an interesting quote. I've actually heard two or three people say this, so apparently it must be bouncing around in one form or another all over the internet. But one of the things that I saw some people post today was, so you say you're not interested in politics. Well, politics is interested in you. It's just overwhelming that we've got this war on women. We've got the right-wing war on immigrants. We've got the right-wing war on the middle class. We've got the right-wing war on workers. We've got the right-wing war on people without insurance. We've got these, it seems like unless you happen to be that one guy that's willing to turn in your own mother so that you can get an extra 50 cents on your paycheck from your boss, it seems like unless you're one of those folks, you're either not going to be working or you're going to be working three or four jobs just to be able to feed your family and pay your bills. And we got to put an end to it. This is a democracy, folks. There's more of us than there are of them. Bill was absolutely right. We are fascinated by the fact that the president was able to turn out so many young people. We had the largest turnout, I guess, almost in my lifetime. I think we had a little bit larger turnout in the JFK election. And after that, I think we have to go all the way back to, I don't know, Eisenhower or maybe FDR to get above the 57% of the turnout of eligible voters that President Barack Obama was able to pull off. So we're looking at, if we look in the state of Florida, if we look at averages, or if we look nationally, if we look at averages, during midterm elections, we're lucky to get over 40% or over, say, 42%. The average is around 41%. In our off election cycles, our midterm elections, over the past 30 years, we've averaged about 41% turnout. And that's the only reason why the right wing is able to push in all of these Louis Gohmerts and I don't know, guess I'd have to refresh my memory. My focus has been on Rick Scott here for the last 6 months, I guess, with the election coming up in November. But we've got so many of these just crazy people. Who was the guy that said in the last election something about women when they get raped, their body has a way to shut down so that they don't get pregnant? I mean, what kind of morons does the right wing put up as candidates and then actually get elected? It's amazing to me. So the only reason that they get elected is because we don't get our folks out to vote. Now, I got to tell you, in Florida, we got a big problem. We had a progressive candidate for governor who ran in the primary. Nan Rich has a history, demonstrated experience representing the progressive community and standing for progressive ideals. And we didn't turn out to vote for her. So now we've got less than a progressive candidate to put up against Rick Scott. Now, I know that's discouraged a lot of my brothers and sisters in the progressive movement here in Florida. And I totally understand how frustrating it is. At the same time, it seems pretty clear to me that we're shooting ourselves in our foot if we don't go out and vote, if not for the other guy, if we don't at least go out and vote against Rick Scott, because the guy's the biggest thief in the United States. He was, I guess, had the privilege of resigning from his CEO position at the Columbia HCA company that he bought from the Frist family here in the Tennessee Frist organization, and but he bought some Florida hospitals and ended up turning it into over a few years into a 55 $55 billion organization. But part of the way he did that was by stealing from Medicare. And Columbia HCA was fined $870 million, but with civil lawsuits, the total number came up to over $1.7 billion, the largest fine in the history of the United States. The largest Medicare fraud that was ever perpetrated was under Rick Scott's leadership of Columbia HCA. And when he was asked about that, he dodged questions and avoided. He came up with some smooth-talking answer. And apparently, if we can believe the tally from votes, apparently a majority of Floridians voted for the thief. So, I mean, I just want to read something from the West Orlando News. This fellow is an ex-Marine, talks about having taken leadership training when he was in the Marine Corps. The fellow's name is, Clymer is, I guess, must be his last name. But he says, let's get down here, at a campaign stop, Scott staffers blocked reporter Michael Putney from boarding the campaign bus because Putney had interviewed Scott's mother. When Putney attempted to board the bus, he was blocked, and the campaign claimed that he had hip-checked the pregnant woman, an assertion that Orlando's WKMG said was directly refuted by the video of the incident, according to WKMG. In July 2010, a veteran political reporter at Local 6, sister station in Miami, says that the Rick Scott campaign staff did a 180 because the reporter interviewed Scott's mother. Mike Putney of television station WPLG attended a campaign stop for the Republican gubernatorial candidate Wednesday in Sweetwater, a small town in Miami-Dade. Putney says the stop went smoothly until he asked Esther Scott a few simple, straightforward questions. Putney claims that staffers insisted that he not air the Esther Scott interview if he wanted access to Scott. The Scott spokesman emailed Local 6 a response to the incident, insisting Putney was not blocked, but instead pushed the staffer. So they make up lies. They're willing to say and do anything. And everybody in the progressive community, I mean, most of us who know who Rick Scott really is, kind of know that, he's a big thief. What a lot of people don't know is that at the same time that he was under investigation at Columbia HCA, there was another case going on in Tampa. And this is actually from the Tampa Tribune. So the Trib writes that the 1990 scandal involving Scott's company, Columbia HCA, overshadowed another investigation, one into which whether Scott and Columbia HCA sought to rig the purchase of what was then the county-owned Tampa General Hospital. No charges were filed in the case, despite a one-and-a-half-year investigation that involved the federal grand jury in Tampa. But that outcome never satisfied the man whose suspicions brought about the investigation, one of Florida's most respected political and civic leaders, the late Fred Carl. In 1995, his career was already nearing its end. Carl was brought in as the TGH president, to quell a public outcry over a possible sale of the hospital and halted the negotiations. What wasn't widely reported then, and what Carl didn't know at the time, was that investigators from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the FBI, and the IRS also looked into another similar complaint in Florida, two involving public or nonprofit hospitals that Columbia HCA wanted to buy. The company, with Scott's direct involvement, was accused of offering public officials and hospital executives benefits, including jobs and gifts, to favorite charities if they could arrange the healthcare contracts or a hospital sale to Columbia HCA. In Tampa case, Carl suspected the hospital officials, including his predecessor as the TGH president, David Busoni, sought to engineer a sale by making the hospital appear to be on the verge of financial collapse. When the TGH board chairman asked Busoni to resign because of his involvement in the sale negotiations, Busoni went to work for Columbia HCA. So we have a history of fraud with this man. We've got his absolute refusal to respond to questions. We've got the fact that he ran on bringing jobs to Florida. His whole campaign promise when he ran in 2010 was that he was going to bring add jobs to as the governor of the state of Florida. Folks, Florida is 47th in out of 50 states in job creation in the last 4 years. One of the first things that this governor did when he came into office was he rejected $2.6 billion from the federal government to build a high-speed bullet train between Miami, Orlando, and Jacksonville. Miami, Orlando, Tampa, Jacksonville. Jacksonville, I'm not sure of. But the high-speed bullet train, $2.6 billion federal money would have created 487 jobs immediately, and I don't know how many, 20,000 jobs immediately, and 487 jobs long-term. So we've got a guy that that came in and did the bait and switch, said that he was going to create jobs, and immediately did everything he could to stop them. He took and gave all of his campaign contributors big, juicy tax cuts and loaded on the tax burden on to the poor and the middle class. Every government employee in the state of Florida, all the state government employees had to start paying for the pension plan that they had received originally when the pensions were initially negotiated. They were negotiated in lieu of getting a raise to keep up with the standard of living, with the cost of living. The cost of living went up. The company says, oh, well, we can't really pay you more money, but here, if we will put some money into a pension plan and you'll have a better retirement, it'll cost us less and it'll give you more security in the future. So taking in lieu of keeping up with the cost of living, these public employees settled for less than they should have gotten at the time when they were negotiating salaries. And then Rick Scott came in and stole that pension from them. He reduced their pensions and made them pay, I'm not sure what the number is. I suppose we got some state government employees out there that could come in. I'm thinking it's like 3% that they have to pay. And all the while, he's given millions of dollars of tax breaks to the private prison industry that was his biggest campaign contributor. Big tax cuts for the wealthy and big tax hikes for people that work for a living, people that were already struggling to keep up. That's the governor that Florida voted for in 2010, and he was a liar in 2010, he was a thief in 2010, and he is just as big of a thief today. So we've got an election coming up in November, and are we going to get on our high horse because we didn't get the progressive candidate that we wanted to elect for governor? It saddens me. Our choice is always the choice of the lesser of two evils. But I'm to anybody listening to this broadcast, I've got to tell you, I can't sit home and be responsible for Rick Scott getting elected again. In fact, if he gets elected again, I have I started a political committee to put an amendment on the ballot to give Florida the right to impeach any state-level elected official. And if Rick Scott gets elected again, I will move forward with that amendment and start collecting signatures. I put it on the back burner because I really was in hopes that we would get a progressive governor, and I didn't want this amendment to be turned around and used on our first progressive governor in 3 decades. But it looks like it might be time to resurface the amendment to give Florida citizens the right to recall state elected officials. The sad thing, folks, is we've got so many issues that we should be working on to make things better. And now it seems like our focus for the foreseeable future is just to prevent the next attack. It's one attack after another. And that kind of brings us full circle to the discussion about the book that we published, Fix America. The objective there was to create this compendium of all the issues that were facing us so that they wouldn't fall through the cracks. So what we found is that after we published the book, now all of a sudden we Senate Bill SB 1070 was coming up right about that time. We had the judge in Wisconsin that was elected with the majority of the votes, but she wasn't the right judge. And so mysteriously, one of the supervisor of elections found a bag of ballots that hadn't yet been counted, and the opening of the bag had a hole in it big enough to fit your hand through, and voila, there were just enough votes to get the right-wing conservative judge elected so that Scott Walker in Wisconsin would be able to pursue anything he wanted without worrying about actually being stopped by the courts, because he got his conservative chief justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, state Supreme Court. We have to overwhelm these folks with votes. We can't sit home. We just can't do it. A lot of my friends are saying, oh, well, you know, I'm going to focus on down ballot elections. Well, again, I'm going to say this from now until election day, first Tuesday in November, not voting for governor is a vote for Rick Scott, because I know that all of Rick Scott's people are going to be out there. They're going to be there and they're going to vote. And if we're not out there voting against him, then we can, I guess, blame ourselves for electing him again. I know there are a lot of folks that are discouraged. And even before the election, we had all of our progressive friends who were all excited about getting an elective progressive candidate, now discouraged. But even before that, in Florida, we have a large number of people sitting at home, not even participating in the process. I'm looking around and I'm seeing, you know, 57% of people turned out for President Barack Obama. That leaves 43% of the people sitting at home not voting, not thinking about politics. Our earlier guest, Bill Bucolo, he pointed out that if he had these 1,000 people that he could sway an election. Well, what if we just add, 5% of those 44 out of 100 people that stay home? 5% would be two out of 100. If we added 2% onto the vote, I think we'd elect pretty much any candidate we wanted. We need to go out and engage these folks, and we need to stop being discouraged and stop staying home and saying, well, if we can't get the perfect candidate, we're just not going to participate at all. We absolutely have to do this. I mean, we've got a Move to Amend organization that's trying to help us win the battle against corporate America with the Citizens United case. In our book, Fix America, we pointed out that this case was probably the worst decision that any Supreme Court had made case in the 1800s that insisted that black people could never be citizens. It'll come to me in a minute. I always have a problem with my memory on these ancient history questions, but this has got to be the worst case since that. And we've got a Supreme Court that's out of control. We've got Clarence Thomas, who apparently cheats on his income taxes, whose wife is running around giving speeches at big national Tea Party events. We've got Alito is going out and having private meetings and fundraisers with right-wing Tea Party candidates like Michelle Bachmann. It's just crazy. We have and Alito even goes out and goes hunting with Dick Cheney a week before he makes a decision relative to a case when Cheney was vice president and says, oh, it's not a conflict of interest. I can be his best friend and rule on his case objectively. We live in an upside-down world. We have an illusion of democracy, and we have the ability to overcome it. There are more of us than there are of them. We just have to start working together, supporting people like Bill, supporting people like Dr. Karen Dwyer in the Everglades, who's working hard to stop the fracking. We should be doggone. I grew up at a time when in the 60s when we thought the world was getting better. We were going to have to work less hours because technology was going to make us more productive. And we thought we were looking at a 30, 35-hour work week in the near future, in the 70s and 80s. Now the 40-hour work week is a myth. Now you can't even expect to go to work for 40 hours and get a decent paycheck. Because if you don't put in an extra 5 or 10 for free for the company, you're going to get downsized the next time the company goes through its cutoffs, its cutbacks, because you're not a team player. You weren't there giving that extra effort. So the idea that we've managed to even hang on to our 40-hour work week is an illusion, let alone being able to reap the benefits of technology and of increased productivity, we are being victimized by a relentless attack from a plutocracy, or as Bernie Sanders likes to call them, from the oligarchy. We have a small group of very wealthy families who have turned the United States into exactly the opposite of what our founding fathers set this country up to be. The founding fathers were opposed to the plutocracy in England and Great Britain. They were opposed to a kingship. And now we've got the Koch brothers trying to set themselves up to be kings. And all of their ALEC buddies that meet out in Palm Springs two or three times or four times a year, all of the princes of industry, they're doing great while everybody else is. We're going to be back where we were when I think it was the guy that owned the mines that called in the National Guard and killed so many of the miners when they went on strike. I don't know if how many of you folks are interested in labor history, the history of the labor movement, and how we won the standard of living that we enjoyed for so many years up until the 80s. But it used to be the case that if you went to work in the mine, you didn't make a lot of money. And, you know, you'd have a family, your kids would be at home, and they'd have to probably go to work in the mine when they were 16, 15, 16 years old, I don't know, maybe 14 years old. But you could go get groceries at the company store, and the company store, of course, was owned by the owner of the mine. So because the mine didn't pay you enough money to be able to afford to actually buy groceries, you'd have to put it on a tab, and they'd keep a tab for you. And, of course, all of the mine's housing was fenced in so that you couldn't get out, and you couldn't leave until you paid your bill. But you could never make enough money to pay your bill. Now, to me, that's functionally equivalent to slavery. That's not functionally equivalent. That is slavery. That's almost overt slavery. So you have a job that doesn't pay you enough to feed your family. So you borrow money from the guy that's not paying you enough to feed your family so that you can buy the groceries so that your family doesn't starve to death. But, oh, by the way, you can't quit till you pay off your bill. And you can't leave to get a good job so that you can get your bill paid off. So that's forced servitude. And that's what we're getting down to in this country today. That's all these people that are – I related the story about the lady in the Starbucks who she was convinced that if people got a living wage, that it would bring total economic collapse to America. People buy into that. And we have to stand up and we have to be strong and we have to work together and we have to be able to live past our frustrations and move this nation forward. It's our generations before us worked too hard. Too many people died in this effort for us to just turn our back on it and say, well, we didn't get perfect, so we're not doing nothing. Move to Amend is a very fine organization. I would encourage everybody that's listening tonight to get involved in the effort to pass a constitutional amendment that says basically two things. Corporations are not people, and money is not speech. I know that corporations or the people, actually the cowardly people that hide behind these corporations, the cowardly wealthy people that hide behind these corporations, I know they would prefer that dollars voted instead of people voting, because as long as they can manipulate your employment so that they can get all of your dollars, then they can use your dollars to buy your politicians. So they much prefer that dollars vote, and we need to make it a point to impose upon the government that we elect that they recognize that dollars are not people, that dollars are not speech. I want to go a little bit farther than Move to Amend does. Move to Amend is a great organization. I'm a big fan of David Cobb, who ran for President of the United States on the Green Party ticket, I think maybe 2004. And the work they're doing is just awesome. We lost another fellow that was involved in Move to Amend that was also president of PDA, who recently died of cancer. This organization is a great organization, and they deserve our support. We need to start chapters in every community and in every state and move this amendment forward. That's an important issue. We've got the minimum wage is an important issue that we should be we shouldn't really even be talking about a minimum wage. What we really need to be talking about is a living wage, because a minimum wage is really just a way to keep the wage level down so that there's more competition for labor in the marketplace. And if we really, I mean, I don't know which person it is that you think that works 40 hours a week that doesn't deserve to earn enough money to pay his or her bills. But in my opinion, I think anybody that gets up, gets out of bed and goes to work 40 hours a week should be able to come home and feed his family, feed her family, be able to pay for the car payment, be able to pay for the insurance on the car, be able to buy the gas to put in the car, be able to buy the school supplies to send the children to school. And you know what? I think if you're working 40 hours a week, you should even be able to get a two-week vacation and have enough money to take your kids to Disney World. It shouldn't just be the upper 1% or 0.1% that is able to take their kids on a vacation. So we've got minimum wage issues. We've got women's reproductive rights issues. And I think, call me crazy, but in my opinion, my honest opinion, I don't think we ought to be working over 25 hours a week. all these good Christians that think that it's the liberals that are responsible for abortion. I got news for you. If you're a good Christian and you're supporting some wealthy guy that's making you work 40 hours a week outside your home, you're not raising your kids. You're sending your kids to school and letting the schools raise them. Don't give me this charter school stuff. That's a whole other thing that's going to get me all riled up here. But you need to be, if you worked a 25-hour work week, you could go to work for 2-3 hours in the morning. You'd have time to drop your kids off at school before you went to work. You'd be able to come home for lunch, pick your kids up, have lunch with them. You'd be able to pick them up after school when they got out of school. You work a couple, 3 hours in the afternoon, 25-hour work week. And guess what? Instead of having a 26% real unemployment rate, it's not 7 or 8%. I think everybody is well aware of that. And if it happens to be in the black community, it's higher than that. If we worked a 25-hour work week, everybody would have a job. And, oh, by the way, when you're working those 25 hours, you should be getting the same amount of money you're getting today for working 40 hours. And guess what? There's plenty of money for that. That's not going to be destroy competition. Everybody's going to be on a level playing field. Everybody has to pay a fair wage, not just the big boys. Everybody pays the fair wage. It's just as competitive. But then instead of the CEO making 400 times as much as his janitor's making, maybe he's only going to make 40 times as much like he did back in the 60s, back in the late 50s and early 60s. You know, folks, we had a 91% income tax rate in the late 50s and the early 60s. When we had that 91% income tax rate on the top wage earners, by the way, the top income tax bracket was on incomes over $300,000 a year. Now, I understand we've had a little bit of inflation. Last time I checked, $300,000 a year was about $7 million in today's dollars. But if we had a 91% income tax rate on all incomes over $7 million, I got news for you. There'd be a whole lot of job creation. You know why? Because if your choice is you make $1 million, you have to give $910,000 of it to the government for taxes, or you can invest the $910,000 in job creation, it's a pretty easy calculation to make. You're going to invest the $910,000 and make your company bigger and make it more profitable rather than giving it to the government. If, on the other hand, I say, well, you know what, you don't even have to pay taxes. You know, we'll let you keep your taxes and beg you to create some jobs. Well, now, what is your incentive to create a job? You know that the poor people are going to have to pay the taxes if you're not paying them, because somebody's got to pay for the roads that you're driving on and for the schools that your employees went to so that they could learn how to read and write and be able to be valuable workers in your factories. Somebody's got to pay for them. If you're not paying for them, that means that the poor people that are already not making enough money to pay their bills are going to have to pay for it. Now, they know that if they're putting every penny they got into just buying food, they're not going to have any money to go out and buy the products that you're making. So why should they invest in more plant and more materials and more labor to build things that nobody's going to have enough money to pay for? They're not going to do that. They're going to take that $1 million and they're going to stick it in their back pocket and they're going to sit on it and hoard it, just like they're doing right now. They've had, if we gave tax cuts to people and that made them create jobs, we'd have more jobs going on right now than we've ever had in my lifetime, because we've got the lowest tax rate today in the United States for people that are in the top 0.1% of this country than we've ever had in my lifetime, and we've got the highest unemployment rate that we've had, real unemployment rate. We just went through the biggest financial crisis in my lifetime in 2008, and we're barely just chugging along and trying to move a little bit forward. But that whole economic doldrum that we're suffering through has been prolonged, not because of the president, but because of a do-nothing Congress that, oh, by the way, we're paying $174,000 to each one of those guys up there. in the House of Representatives. That's about, I don't know, 400 times $174,000. What's that? So about $500 million it costs us just for their salaries. Forget their offices and forget all the extra expense money that they're getting. If they're not going to do anything, why should we spend that $500 million on letting them live a life of luxury? That's what's keeping us in the doldrums. So we got all of these issues that we should be working for. We should be in the 21st century. We've got productivity coming out the yin-yang. We should be having the most comfortable lifestyles in America in my lifetime. And here we are struggling because of greed, because of the greed of a few people that have convinced apparently a majority of people in Florida that it's going to be good to not make so much money, that it's going to be good to elect a guy that steals their pensions from them, that it's going to be good to elect a guy that is getting his campaign funds from private prisons so that these private prisons can be incentivized to make sure that more people go to jail. And, oh, you know what? It might be a good system, I guess, because if you don't give people money, they're going to have to do something to eat. So I guess you're going to have prisons to keep them in. And then these private prison companies, they can charge those prisoners money that they don't have. And then when they can't pay, then the taxpayers are going to have to pay. And guess what? The taxpayers are you and me. It ain't those one percenters. It's not those one-tenth of one percenters, because those guys got the big tax cuts. So if you want a governor that's going to keep shifting his tax burdens onto the rest of us and giving all those tax breaks to his rich buddies that are paying for his campaign, then you go right on ahead and vote for Rick Scott, or don't vote at all, because Rick Scott will have his people out there. But if you care a little bit about your future and about the future of your kids, then I say go vote for the other guy, not because you necessarily think he's going to be the best that we could have had, but because the alternative is hell. The alternative is another 4 years, and we can't afford another four like the last four, folks. This is Florida. We shouldn't be going through these kinds of trials and tribulations down here. We should have a very booming economy. We've got people wanting to come to this state from all over the world. And there's no reason at all why people should be working for no money at all and then just having to live out of their car or day to day without knowing where the next meal is coming from. It's time for a change. It's time to pink slip Rick. It's time to fire the bum and get him out of there. And, you know, I don't know how else to tell you that this is a serious issue, this election. We need to not have 41% of our population out there. We need to have 51%, and if we have 51%, we'll win. And I know that it's not going to be what you might prefer or like, but at least it won't be the hell that it will be if we end up with another 4 years of this thief. So I'm just going to play a little song here, take a little breather, and then I'll come back and I'll say thank everyone for joining us on PNN tonight. Thank you all for listening to my ranting. I'm going to actually put some of these rants together and start playing them as little jingles here in the coming days and weeks as we get this Tuesday show up and running. And I'll share a little bit more about you, about what Tuesday night's Welcome to Reality with Rob is going to be about as we move to expand the PNN offering of progressive information and updates. So in the meantime,
you'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Tell me. Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner, and I'm a miner's son. He'll be with you fellow workers until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Sing it!
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Oh, workers, can you stand it? Tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab, or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me which side are you on? Which side are you on? Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Tell me which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Tell me which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
So a lot of our friends, a lot of the folks in our communities are really big Woody Guthrie fans and Pete Seeger fans. And I know that when I was growing up, I used to sing a song in school plays called This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land. That's how it goes. I'm not sure. I guess it's This Land Is Your Land is the name of the song. But we used to sing this song, and we I didn't really know a lot about it when I first would sing it. But it turns out that Woody Guthrie is really a big Union fan, and we need our unions today. We're coming to the end of the show. I'm going to keep broadcasting, and this will be in the podcast, so you'll be able to hear the rest of it if you want to come and join the show. But Woody Guthrie was a big Union man, and I've heard a lot of folks say over the past 10, 15, 20 years that, oh, yeah, well, you know, there was a time when we needed unions, but that time's come and gone. We don't need unions anymore. Oh, the unions are all corrupt. And, of course, you know, it just like they said that the 8-hour workday would cause world economic collapse, just like they said in the 30s that Social Security would bankrupt America, just like all the things that people who want you to live in poverty so that you can be kept in slave conditions. Just like they've always said that whatever next benefit that the increase of productivity and of our abilities to sustain ourselves on this planet, whatever that brings to us, we should be able to be entitled to. They have always said, the powers that be have always blocked it. They've always drugged their feet. They've always said it will bring world economic collapse. Just as that has been ongoing for as long as we have been moving forward, as long as there has been a progressive movement, that is what is being said today. And so what I hear is people regurgitating these lies from the one percenters and the one-tenth of one percenters, that if we are if can have a living wage, that that's going to bring total economic collapse. Reality couldn't be any starker. The contrast between that and reality couldn't be any starker. The reality is that when you pay people more money, there are more people to buy your product. And when there are more people to buy your product, you have more reason to want to invest in that product. And then you are going to hire people, and it creates a big economic resurgence. And until we get some kind of an offsetting power to the liars, the people that are stealing from you, until we get something strong enough to go up against that power structure, and the unions have been that thing, that the ability of people to work together collectively to bargain with these one percenters that are greedy thieves, until we recognize that we need to support these labor organizations, we're going to continue to face the kinds of onslaughts against the middle class and the onslaughts against the rights of workers and the rights of women and the rights of immigrants and the rights of children and the rights of everybody that these greedy guys want to enslave. I'd like to use some other language here, but I'm trying to keep it fit for the young folks there too. We need the labor organizations. We need to support them. We have a history, and we have a pretty strong example before us from our ancestors of participation in the labor movement and all of the benefits that that participation in the labor movement has brought. I was hoping to go out with a song by World Entertainment War called Apathy and Ignorance, but it looks to me like it's going to take too long for that to process. So I'm going to say good night to our PNN audience with a song from Woody Guthrie that is one that we play here often on PNN, and it's called There's a Better World a Coming. So thank you all for joining me this first Tuesday night of the Welcome Back to Reality show with Rob. I'm looking forward to spending more time on the weeknights for your drive home. Maybe we can make a difference and create a better future for our children and the succeeding generations. So having said all that, I just want to say there is a better world to come. And good night to everyone that was kind enough to join me.
There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. We will beat them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. There's a better world a-coming, and don't you know, no. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you know. I'm a union man in a union war. It's a union world I'm fighting for. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you know. There's a better world that's a-coming. There's a better world that's a-coming. There's a better world that's a-coming. I'll tell you why. Don't you see. And don't you know, no. Hey, there's a better world to come. I'll tell you why. There's a better world to come. I'll tell you why. There's a better world to come. I'll tell you why. Better world to come. I'll tell you why. Out of marching, out of battling, you can hear the chains are rattling. There's a better world to come. I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, and there's a better world that's a-coming, and there's a better world that's a-coming, and I'll tell you why. a better world that's a-coming. I'll tell you why. Better world that's a-coming. I'll tell you why. We'll beat them on the land, in the sea, and in the sky.